And hello everybody, welcome to Trolling With Logic for 7th of April 2013. I'm your host Zulu Fightrunner / Trolling With Logic, also introducing my emergency co-host Sir Strife or Lion Ghost Show. Please say hello.
Hello.
Okay, like I say, we are a live kind of call-in show / podcast. So if you do want to call in, add the Skype contact Trolling With Logic. Just send me a message with the gist of the question. And also, please remember, when you call in, you're granting us permission to use your likeness because the show is recorded, uploaded to iTunes and YouTube. So, and also, if you can't get on today or if you have any feedback, the email address, as you can see at the bottom of your screen, is contact@trollingwithlogic.com. So I will now introduce our special guest for today. He is an American lawyer, a political socialist activist, a well-known proponent of the Establishment Clause, also a very keen debater as well. He's kind of debated William Lane Craig, Matt Smith, Todd Friel, many people, and also has the honour of the chair of the First Amendment Task Force for the Council of Secular Humanism. Please, everyone, welcome Edward Tabash to the show. Welcome, Edward.
Thank you very much. Also, just wanted to point out that in November of last year, I was made chair of the board of directors of the Center for Inquiry and the Council for Secular Humanism.
Nice. Sir Strife, I think you had a few questions to start as well.
Oh, well, it was your show. You were going to do the separation of church and state, right?
Yeah. No? Well, we'll go with that. So, like I say, Eddie, you're a kind of lawyer and you specialize in separation of church and state. So can you give us a rundown of what your kind of day-to-day job is? And like,
well, how many people would be in the United States and how many would be in the UK? Because that might determine how I initially explain this.
I think we're a very mixed show. So I think play to like a non-US audience would be best.
Well, I'm guessing... I would guess most likely British because right now it's 1 o'clock and 1 o'clock in the afternoon in America.
Okay.
I mean
well,
Eastern.
Then,
Eastern.
Okay. What I would say then is we have in the United States a written constitution that explicitly, though the actual history of it is sparse, yet the framing of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, even with a sparse record, remarkably shows that James Madison, the future fourth president of the United States, being guided by Thomas Jefferson, the then third president of the United States, explicitly intended for believers and non-believers to be equal before the law, for government to be neutral. Just four years before drafting the First Amendment, in opposing religious assessments that would aid all religions in his native Virginia, Madison said, and what has been the consequences of almost 1,500 years of Christian rule? Corruption, indolence in the clergy. And Thomas Jefferson wrote, it does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no god. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. Now, today's religious right wing and the 4.4 people they have on the Supreme Court, as opposed to the 4.6 people we have, take the view that government can side with all religions collectively against non-belief, all monotheistic religions that cannot favor one religion over others, but chillingly, as Justice Scalia has written, that the First Amendment does not protect the devout atheist. And even more extreme is Justice Clarence Thomas, who takes the view that each of the 50 states should be free to have their own official religion. Now, in contrast to this, we show that the final wording, no law respecting an establishment of religion, means no law even showing respect to an establishment of religion. If the framers in 1789 were interested only in preventing government from favoring one sect over others, but would allow a collective siding with religion against non-belief, they would not have rejected two proposed wordings which did just that. In September of 1789, when the First Amendment was in the Senate before the conference resulted in the final wording, there were two proposals rejected. One, no religion shall be established over any other, and no sect elevated over any other. And yet those were rejected for the broader language. Also, in the months leading up to the drafting of the First Amendment, Madison wrote to Jefferson his fear that the majority would narrow the rights of conscience if given the chance and would deny infidels the right to hold office. So this sets the stage for why today's religious right is incorrect. What I do, also in conjunction with my work as chair of the National Legal Committee of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, is I participate in litigation that does not want to disadvantage the religion of anyone, but wants to make sure religion does not enjoy special privilege. For instance, when we have religious displays on public property, they are unconstitutional. And so there are numerous lawsuits to take down various crosses off of public property. I was very supportive of the litigation American Atheists brought in the state of Utah, where to commemorate fallen Utah State Trooper police officers, they lined highways with crosses. Now, to show you how ridiculous this becomes, many religious right-wing judges, in trying to uphold the display of crosses, will say that the Latin cross is no longer a religious symbol but a secular one. Well, when is the last time you've seen a Latin cross atop a Jewish grave? So that's preposterous. The other things that we deal with are the efforts on the part now, unfortunately, of the very powerful Catholic Church to exempt not just the church itself, but any believing Catholic from having to provide contraception coverage for their employees, though they cover other prescription medication. And our argument is, unless you're the church itself that has a doctrinal right, if you're merely the participant or believer of a religion, you have no right to discriminate, to use your religion to discriminate against members of the general public. So that's sort of an overview of the law and its application. Another reason that I was so fervently involved in the president's reelection campaign is whether there is church-state separation in America depends exclusively on who sits on the Supreme Court. For those of you in the UK, the United States Supreme Court is, as it should be, an unelected body answerable to no one. The justice is serving for life. But their interpretation of the Constitution is what the Constitution means. So right now there are 4.6 justices that say government must treat the non-believer equally and 4.4 justices that allow some kind of preference for religion, with Justice Kennedy being the swing vote. So had Romney won and replaced elderly Justice Ginsburg, for the first time ever, we would have five justices to adopt Scalia's view that the devout atheist is not protected by the Constitution. So this is the unique technical aspect of whether or not America is a secular democracy or has theocratic elements to its government.
Okay, just going to very quickly introduce Mortimer.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you loud and clear. There Great. Was sort of a kind of question related to that. It's from Polly Chaser, who's in the Netherlands. And they're basically asking, why do you feel that the case is in America that so many people believe the country is founded as a Christian nation?
That's an excellent question, and I think it's very important that someone from one of the most socially liberal nations ask that question, and this also points out a problem even with liberal countries, which I will get to. Right now, the Netherlands is having a problem It's not just a problem with the religious right, but also countries that have a leftist social orientation frequently bend over backwards to protect religion. I mean, Ayaan Hirsi Ali had to leave Holland because of the Muslim outcry, and now, even after the murder of filmmaker Theo van Gogh, there's a blasphemy law in Holland that makes it illegal to insult Islam, and this is not tolerable. We cannot say to any religion, you have special rights to avoid being offended. But as far as America's unique situation is concerned, we have a twin track that has been applicable, I would say, since after the founding or even before from our puritanical roots. We are an advanced technological society, but there is also another track of a simple-minded kind of religious assent where one is deemed to be morally praiseworthy if one mindlessly buys into religious dogma without questioning. For instance, now this has been primarily the result of the religious right-wingers, but let me say on behalf of conservatives, you can be a true conservative and believe in the free enterprise system, as did Ayn Rand, and not be a believer. It just happens that in the United States, general conservatism and religious fundamentalism go together. They don't have to by any kind of logic. But look at Ronald Reagan's campaign for president in 1980, when the religious right first came to power, and they asked him why he believed in God, and he said it would be the same as looking at a great meal and saying there's no cook. Or George Bush in 2000, when asked who his favorite political philosopher was, and said it was Jesus, and said Jesus told him to run. It seems that there are millions of Americans that still regard simple-minded, unquestioning acceptance of religious dogma as a virtue, and that's a cultural strain. The other thing I would say is that unlike Europe, we have not had religious wars fought on our soil, so we don't have a history of bloodshed of American against American. We've had over slavery in the Civil War, but we've never had Americans killing each other because of disagreements over what is to become of them after they die.
Can I state something about that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I guess you could say the thing about slavery was kind of a religious thing because they both used passages from the Bible to try to say our side is right and your side is wrong. They tried to do that, the religious fundamentalists on both sides.
Yeah, we see there's a difference between religious people each trying to use a religious text to justify something and people killing each other on the same soil because they disagree over which religion is true.
But it's not – no, but it's the same religion they're disagreeing on. They're disagreeing on what it says.
Right. But that's – they're disagreeing on what it said, but that's not the same as which religion should the government favor. You see, the fight we're having – the fight we're having on church-state separation is which religion the government should favor, and should religion generally be able to trump other law, and should law – the ultimate question of church-state separation in the United States comes down to this. Should any law be grounded, be permissibly grounded in religion?
Well, I mean, I was just replying to the statement you said that because Europe had religious wars and the United States didn't. That's kind of what I was replying
to. Yeah, but the Civil War was not a religious war.
No, there may have been
components of motivation.
Yes. That's what I'm trying to
say. But it didn't compare to decades of Protestants and Catholics slaughtering each other.
Well, that happened after the Articles of Confederation were made. It happened, the Protestants and the Catholics were killing each other again.
Yes. But I'm just saying that the Civil War was not known as sect versus sect.
Yes.
And
Yes,
and,
but,
and so the unique European experience had for centuries been sect versus sect, and also the religious persecutions. On American soil, we didn't have an Inquisition.
Would you say Salem would be closest?
Salem, but you see, Salem would be close, but that was not society versus society. Salem, unfortunately, was everybody in the government favoring the persecution of these women.
Yeah, so it was society against its own people.
It was society against its own people, but it wasn't a war.
The Inquisition wasn't like a war. It was more of a persecution of
– It was a persecution, but it had widespread support across many nations. And now I would say this, though, that the Salem persecutions do have a residue today in the demonization of today's religious right of persons who live differently. So I would say that, though now it's on the wane, that the type of hostility against alternative belief systems stem from that, and even though it didn't have a murderous component, the fear of the heretic, though it didn't arise to the religious conflicts in Europe, the fear of the heretic, I think, fuels the virulent hatred of atheists, and even the now waning but still very powerful anti-gay movement in the United States. But the most important point is that America historically and through the present day has had this twin track of technological involvements and at the same time a kind of backward religious fundamentalism where the application of intellectual rigor to the claims of religious dogma is not appreciated in many parts of the country.
Would you say this would possibly have to do with the period of time after the Civil War, though? Because that's what I've maybe noticed with American history, that the rise of the religious fundamentalist movements were like in the 1980s. I mean, 1890s, like the beginning of the century.
It may have. Thomas Jefferson predicted, unfortunately he was wrong, we'd be much better off, predicted that by 1830 everyone would be Unitarians in America. And of course that didn't happen. That didn't happen. And you see, the Jefferson, Madison, and most of the framers were, of course, children of the European Enlightenment. And to them, what they were doing is they were taking it the next step by keeping religion a matter of conscience. If you look at the very sparse but still existing record of the debates in the First Congress on the First Amendment and the words of Madison, you can see that uppermost in the minds of the founders, prior to all other considerations, was the protection of the rights of conscience, irrespective of where that belief system led. Daniel Carroll, one of the original signers, Declaration of Independence, in the debate in the House of Representatives on the First Amendment, said the rights of conscience are so delicate that they will little bear even the gentlest touch of governmental hand. And then in 1821, years after Jefferson and Madison got the 1786 Bill for Religious Liberty through the Virginia legislature, and this is the most telling of all. So many years later, Jefferson exulted in his autobiography that the bill that he and Madison pushed through the Virginia legislature 3 years before the First Amendment was even drafted, 3.5 years, that there were efforts to restrict its protections only to Christian sects, but that the final result, in Jefferson's words, were that he and Madison were able to protect the infidel of every denomination. And then when you look at the original Constitution of 1787, even before the Bill of Rights, that had only one reference to religion, a negative one, Article 6, Clause 3, prohibiting any religious test for public office. The intent is clear. Also, and this is the most important, and I want particularly the people listening in Europe to understand this, the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights is a minority protection document. What it says is it doesn't matter if 99% of the people want to do something, they cannot encroach on the rights of the 1%. And this is how, from the free speech area, we're able to say, regardless of how offensive, regardless of how unpopular a form of expression is, mere offensiveness or revulsion by an overwhelming majority does not allow for its banning.
You can't have, I guess, for example, in Europe would be the best example, would be like you can't have a totalitarian regime kind of thing, right?
Well, it's not just totalitarianism. It's there are specific things government can't do.
Yes.
I guess the best example of this is the flag-burning cases of 1989 and 1990. At the 1984 Republican convention, a young man, self-styled radical, to protest Ronald Reagan and his renomination for president, burnt in public his own replica of the American flag. It's not that he tore the flag down from a government building. He bought his own flag and set it on fire. He was prosecuted for desecrating the American flag. Well, upwards of 90% of the American people thought that that should be a punishable crime. But in a brilliant Supreme Court decision of Texas versus Johnson, in a 5-4 decision, Justice Brennan wrote that as long as he was not destroying public property, the mere outrage and the mere offense and horror that people feel at seeing an American flag being damaged or purposely destroyed is not a basis for its banning, because there is no extent under the Free Speech Clause of the First Amendment where offensiveness by itself reaches a level sufficient to allow the majority to ban the expression of something.
Okay. Just going to introduce Lundy very quickly. Welcome to the show, Lundy.
Yeah, sorry I'm late.
Okay, no problem. Mortimer, you've been waiting quite a while with a question.
Yeah. To go back to the subject of the U.S. Civil War being a religious or not religious, I can just bring up an example from Europe to sort of get the difference across, I think. For those who don't know, I live in Sweden, actually I used to live just about a kilometer or so from what used to be a battlefield. Well, it's still a historical battlefield. There's a memorial there and stuff. And that's basically the site of the battle where it was decided that Sweden would be a Protestant nation and not a Catholic nation. And we're talking about a huge battle between Protestants and Catholics. And this is it was a complete slaughter, and the Protestants kicked major ass, by the way. This one battle, it completely dwarfs the kinds of wars that were going on in Europe around that time. This was, I think, maybe a century or so, well, within a century around the 30-Year War, which was all over Europe, especially in Germany and France. And it was Protestants versus Catholics. and that's nothing like what the U.S. Civil War was. So I just wanted to weigh in on that.
Yeah, because you see, at the end of the Civil War, nobody said the victors, the North versus the South, have now established the hegemony of one religion over another. See, that wasn't the
result.
See, that's why we don't call it a religious war. I also want to say that if one of the hosts, because I don't want to have to answer a lot of emails, but if one of the hosts wants to email me, who has my email, I will send you the brief that I, as a PDF that I did in the same-sex marriage case, the first case before the California Supreme Court, where I give a definitive statement of what separation of church and state is, and then anybody can email the host and get a copy. Now, what's significant here is that many of those supporting same-sex marriage argued that under the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause, the United States Constitution, the Equal Protection of All People Clause that was enacted after the Civil War, that one can't discriminate against gay people anyway. I agreed with that, but I took a different approach. I said that since the effort to confine marriage to heterosexuals is grounded in religious doctrine, it violates the separation of church and state and must be struck down, and gays and lesbians must be permitted to marry. So that's also an additional window into how us church-state separationists think. We also, in the 1970s Supreme Court case of Lemon versus Kurtzman, there was a any legislation must have a secular purpose. That's the first prong. It may not serve to either inhibit or advance religion by its intent and must avoid excessive government entanglement with religion. See, what we are talking about is neutrality. None of us want religion to have lesser rights. We don't want it to have more. But what the religious right wing does is the religious right wing claims that unless they have special rights, they're being discriminated against. Now, yeah. In a particularly obnoxious comment, religious right-wing leader, the preacher Pat Robertson, said that Christians in America are facing the same situation as Jews in Germany. Well, my mother was an Auschwitz survivor, so I found that completely offensive, but I would still defend his free speech right to say that. But that's what it actually comes down to. Many religious right-wingers want special privilege. They're afraid of equality. And what we want is for the non-believer to have equal rights, but no lesser rights. Let me give you an example of where we church-state separationists stood by a religion, a minority religion, in terms of this equality principle. In the case of the Church of Babalui versus City of Hialeah, Florida, the City of Hialeah, Florida, passed a law that discriminated only against religion. And it gave the religion lesser rights. What it said was there were a number of people of that Cuban African religion, the Santeria religion, present in that city. Must have been a number of Cuban and Haitian immigrants that brought the religion there. And this was in the 1990s or 1980s. And they said, you can kill animals for any purpose except for religious purposes. So what that means is if you decide just to slaughter a chicken just for no reason, that's okay. But if you slaughter a chicken and say, aha, I did that for a religious reason, then it would be a prosecutable crime. And so we church-state separationists argued that you can't give any religion lesser rights than anyone else. So, I mean, you can see that we are principled here in the way we approach this.
Okay, I think Lundy had some questions. you were wanting to come in.
I had a little bit of a question, and you'll have to pardon me. My voice isn't exactly the best right now. Going back a little bit, you established that in the original Bill of Rights, it was very clear that if 99% of what the country wants to do has to do with infringing the rights of the other 1%, they're not allowed to do that. There is no mob rule in our democracy, which kind of prevents it from being a 100% democracy, which is not a bad thing. So I have to ask, like, in the history of the discussions between the Founding Fathers and how they established this, how did they come to that conclusion? Like, what was the foundation of that not being allowed to happen?
Oh, the foundation was, first of all, the first thing was, and I asked the Brits to forgive me, but the not too benevolent view of the Church of England at the time, the experience of state establishments in the colonies prior to the revolution, and also, as you could see, by all the debates and the discussions between Madison and Jefferson and the position of Congressman Carroll, that uppermost was protecting the rights of conscience. You see, what the founders really wanted to say is, we don't care what an American believes in, and that no one's views should affect their legal freedoms. Now, in the Bill for Religious Liberty in Virginia, enacted by Madison and Jefferson in 1786, you see language to this effect, which shows what they were thinking when Jefferson was assisting Madison in preparing the first draft of the First Amendment. They said, our civil rights should depend no more on our views on religion as they do on our views of physics and geometry. So what they were uppermost concerned about, prior to all other considerations, the foundation of the foundation, the ultimate bedrock, was the protection of the rights of conscience of each individual, irrespective of what the belief system was. So that can't mean anything other than the equality of the non-believer, because first of all, they said so openly, and secondly, if your uppermost objective is to make sure that the rights of conscience are deemed so precious and delicate that you have to stay the hand of government, then you're not going to allow any point of view on matters of religion to result in lesser rights for the holder of those views than someone else.
Okay, Lundy, do you have anything to follow up with? Lundy? Lundy, I think you're muted.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was muted.
Could I add something? For those of you in Europe right now, I would ask that you be very, very vigilant, because like some late-night horror movie where the giant monster has been asleep and all of a sudden it comes back to life, I was extremely chagrined that even after the most massive exposés of worldwide, not just child abuse by Catholic priests, but cover-ups at the highest level, that the world greeted the selection of the new pope as if he were the ultimate celebrity. And those few moments before he stepped out on the balcony revealing his identity, the entire world was riveted as if it really mattered which one of their own a group of cardinals chose. So I would ask all of you in Europe, particularly as we now have to be in the United States, to watch the Catholic Church very carefully and to make sure that their efforts to restrict personal freedom and to undo particularly Western Europe's hard-fought secularism requires constant vigilance. It is
Absolutely.
Astounding Yeah, it is astounding that the church received so much attention and respect after these worldwide child abuse scandals.
Okay. I totally agree.
Lundy, you had a question there, and then we'll go to our caller.
I didn't really have anything to add as far as my last question was concerned. I think it was sufficiently answered. The only thing that I think is just an interesting thing to point out is that generally when the religious argue with atheists, one of the points that sometimes comes up is the lack of ability for a secular morality to actually make any sort of sense of the world. You have to have a Christian morality. You can't have any way. You don't, you have no base. You have no foundation to say that this is wrong or that's wrong, that you can't do this, that they can't do that. And it seems strange to me because clearly for hundreds and hundreds of years, if not more, and I would say much more than that, this has been done on a regular basis, not just for the Founding Fathers, but for them. You could go all the way back to the pre-Socratics. I mean, they were questioning the notion of any sort of need for a divine morality even back then. So I think it's very interesting how we have the Founding Fathers who, at least a decent amount of them, you could say, would count as a Christian of some sort. And yet they don't base what the laws they were making, the laws of the land, off of their Christianity. The only one that I think even possibly did that in it, or at least attempted to do that to any extent, would be Alexander Hamilton. And even then, he was about like one out of many.
Well, I think it's a very important point that you raise. Remember that Thomas Jefferson was a theist for many of the founders. And basically, Thomas Jefferson believed in a founding unknown deity. As he wrote to John Adams in the 1820s, when both of them were well retired from the presidency, of the nature of this being, we know nothing. And then in April of 1823, Jefferson, the retired third president of the United States, wrote to Adams, the retired second president of the United States, and said the idea of Jesus springing forth from the womb of a virgin will be classed with the same fable as Minerva springing forth from the head of Jupiter. So remember, to Thomas Paine, one of the true founders of the American Revolution, who in his Age of Reason wrote one of the most historically devastating critiques of the Bible, and to Jefferson, and to those who were Unitarians or deists, there was no deity that you could supplicate. A Jefferson's God, whatever it was, would not respond to prayers or pay attention to us. So he was not a Christian. Now, they may have wanted people to believe in something as a way of social control, but that was more by way of moral admonition than by law. For instance, in his second inaugural address, Jefferson explicitly stated he won't even be giving Thanksgiving proclamations because he felt they were religious exercises. I mean, would that a president of the United States would do that today? It was amazing, simply amazing. So, And Madison, in his detached memoranda that he wrote around 1817 after leaving office, even disapproved of the right of religious entities to hold property. So the closer the actual founders themselves were far more radical in their separation of church and state than what we have today. So you can see that. You can see that they truly wanted government neutrality in matters of religion and truly championed the equality of the non-believer. It was incredible.
Okay, I think we can introduce our caller, Steve. You've been waiting very patiently.
Hello. I hope my mic's working here.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Hey, Steve.
Right, so, hi. All right, so one of the questions I had was, well, obviously start off
in America with this vision of an all-inclusive society. But then as it developed over time, up to the 1960s especially, you've got added coinage, you've got God added to coins, and God we trust, you get it added to pledges, etc. And it seems, well, coming from a British perspective, this seems almost comical, just astoundingly foreign, because over in England, instead of the church getting more powerful over time, it just completely shrunk to be almost transcended past it. Yet in America, it seems to have just been the central point about politics and law and these debates. And well, to sum up, the question really is just what happened? How did it get to this state?
Can I possibly have an explanation? Even though I possibly don't know all of it, but I would say possibly because the enemy then was communism, if I recall right. Edward, would you agree?
Yes. Well, here's the thing. Again, look
godless
at the
godless atheistic communism.
Let's go back to my twin tracks of American history. The striving for technological advance and yet that strain of fundamentalism, which has been with us throughout. And that's what leads to this. Now, another example of this is in the past month, we have seen by religious motivation, state legislatures, even though we still have the 1973 Roe versus Wade decision that grounded a woman's right of choice on abortion and Constitution, prohibiting states individually from banning it, we have seen in not just the South, but even in the North, in the Midwest, most virulent anti-abortion legislation trying to challenge this law. In North Dakota, banning all abortions, and now Kansas. None of these are done with no one has stood up and said, well, I'm an atheist or a secular humanist, but I have a biological scientific view that personhood attaches at the moment of fertilization. So you also have to understand that there's one unique kind of dangerous silliness in America. No society is more almost like 12-year-old boys childishly preoccupied with sex, simultaneously with looking for ways to restrict sexual freedom. And the way this comes out is when you see some of the most arch-religious fundamentalist high-ranking politicians having had extramarital affairs or dalliances with women for pay. So it is, I would say, a kind of adolescent sexual immaturity that results from the interplay of the normal biological development of people along with the strain of religious fundamentalism that gives rise to this American spectacle of being more enamored of sexual scandal than anything else, at the same time as large numbers of Americans want their legislative bodies to ban all sorts of avenues to sexual freedom.
Okay. Steve, does
right. that... Thanks a lot.
All right.
Cheers.
Thanks for your question.
Yeah. Shall I just end the call? Or?
No, I'll remove you. Don't worry.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for your question. Lundy, do you have something to come in with there?
Yeah, I do. As far as the whole abortion debate goes, I always find it interesting. Whenever that comes up, it's such a convoluted subject when you let people come up with all the reasons that they do. But I think a lot of the anti-abortion rhetoric tends to be centered around, I wouldn't say necessarily religious notions, because you will find your atheistic pro-lifer at some point. I just find it very interesting because whenever I engage with this, the general notion tends to be centered around what makes someone a person. When does someone become a person in the world? When does that, when are their rights starting to be protected as persons in the womb? And to be honest, I just find it extremely strange. Like, before I give my opinion on it, what exactly would you say your take is on the entirety of the debate?
Well, first of all, I think on rare occasion, and it happens that you might find a person who has no belief in a supernatural being who will have differing ideas of when a fetus should be entitled to the full protections of a human being. However, I don't think that you will find non-believers saying that at the point that sperm meets egg, that a person comes into being. So when you have, for instance, efforts to ban stem cell research, and there's even an admission that a soul enters at fertilization, or saying that you can't even have post-fertilization means of birth control, such as IUDs or certain types of birth control pills that prevent an already fertilized egg from attaching to the uterine wall. When you have those types of views, which is what characterizes much of the state legislation, you're not going to find very many secular people supporting that. So I also think, once again, that you don't find on a nationwide level or even in the states major anti-abortion organizations in their leadership or foot soldiers consisting of other than the religious. So the debate is still tarnished, if you will, by religious doctrine. Now, a step forward would be if all of these subjects could be debated without the taint of religious dogma. But you see, the problem that we have in America in terms of church-state separation is when someone says, my religion tells me what my neighbor wants to do is wrong, so I want the police power of the state to forcibly stop my neighbor from doing so. That's the, you see, this is the core of what we're dealing with in today's discussion. And that's what I believe is unconstitutional.
Lundy?
See, my whole thing, like, aside from the religious aspect of, the, you know, the soul enters the fetus at conception and all that kind of stuff. No, you know what? I'll discuss that too. I've looked up a lot concerning the history of the abortion debate, and it seems to me that if you want to say, firstly, that the soul or personhood or whatever starts at conception, that's a very vague thing to say because conception medically takes at least 24 hours to even take in the first place. So that's a 24-hour period that you can't actually nail down a particular moment in time in which it happens. But if you want to say, oh, well, it happens after that. It happens after the 24-hour period. Okay, well, what about the 2 to 4 weeks, or maybe I think it's maybe 4 or 6 weeks that happens afterwards in which the fetus starts twinning? What about that? What happens in that point? Is that a person becoming two persons? Is that, and how does that even work? How does a person become two persons all of a sudden? Does the soul split? Is there like a half a soul in each one? Does another soul just like grow? Exactly. Were there two souls to begin with? How does that work? And then you have the notion of, I forget exactly what the phenomena is called, but later on throughout the gestation period, sometimes a twin will eat another twin. Not out of any sort of conscious desire to do so, but it just sort of happens. So will you say, okay, well, that twin just murdered the other twin? I don't think anybody would really convict a fetus of murdering another fetus.
You're giving them ideas.
For our purposes, the point is, at what point does somebody with a religious motive claim appropriately that they have adduced enough objective evidence to put a ban in place. And this is how we have – this is the filter through which we have to view these issues. At what point does the religionist say, irrespective of my theological views, there's sufficient objective evidence that the woman should no longer be able to terminate the pregnancy, or that these two men should not be able to marry? You see, if somebody is motivated by religion, but the law that they propose can stand alone, let's say, for instance, somebody says that you should only be able to drive 25 miles per hour through a school district, and my personal motivation is God whispered that into my ear, but here are 10 years of statistics proving objectively that it's much safer than a 40-mile-per-hour speed limit through the school district. Well, as long as the law has an independent secular leg which is sufficient to hold it, there won't be a violation, because a violation of church-state separation occurs only when the law under which we all have to live cannot survive, will fall without a religious component. So I might believe that in order somebody might believe that we can't shoot people on the beach in California because it's God's will. But there is so much independent corroborating secular-based evidence for prohibiting such massacring of people on the beach that it doesn't matter, because it stand alone without a crutch of religion. So our is that once there is a law enforceable by the police power of the state under which we all must live, that that law not be tainted with the religious component.
I completely agree with that. As far as, well, going back to abortion for a moment, as far as the abortion debate goes, I invite everyone, our viewers, as well as the panel, as well as I'm not quite sure if our guest has considered this avenue of consideration, but it's a fairly popular one. There is a notion of the idea that personhood, in fact, doesn't matter within consideration of the abortion debate, like whether or not they are a person throughout the entirety of the 9-month period. None of that matters, because the more important thing to take into consideration is the autonomy, the bodily autonomy of the woman. There was an argument put forth, I forget exactly when, it was either the 70s or the 80s, called the violinist argument, which essentially concluded, won't get into the whole thing right now, but what it concluded was, under no circumstance is someone to have their body used against their will. They're not morally obligated to have their body used against their own will. So if something is living inside of them and they desire that not to happen, then they have that right to terminate that. And regardless of whether or not it is a person that is being destroyed as a result, that bodily autonomy is more important.
Well, again, I think it was in the 70s that philosopher Judith Jarvis Thompson came up with this analogy that if you wake up in a hospital and you are attached kidney to kidney to some great scientist, and only by continuing to be attached to them for 9 months and giving of your bodily functions to sustain them will this scientist survive, that you're not required to do so, even if detaching yourself means that the scientist will die. So by analogy, she argued that a woman shouldn't be required against her will to give of her bodily functions to sustain a fetus. So, I mean, that was one of the other arguments. But again, for our purposes, I think that even in the abortion debate, and certainly in the gay rights debate, this must all be extracted out of the religious realm. And our objective in church-state separation is that the legislative debates that will result in laws binding on all of us not have a religious component and have a clear rational basis that's tethered in empirical research, not in someone's concept of the will of a divine being. I mean, that is what the separation of church and state means in terms of the creation of day-to-day law that we all have to live under.
All right. So, as far as the abortion debate goes, I personally agree that any sort of religious notion of when the soul enters the thing, none of that really matters to me. Even if it was the case, I will grant absolutely every premise that they want to give. Like the soul enters the fetus at conception. Sure, why not? We'll go with that. Still doesn't matter. In the long run, still doesn't matter because the analogy that was given. You are not forced to use your body to sustain someone else. It does not matter if it is alive. It doesn't matter if it has a soul. All of this is completely irrelevant to the notion as to whether or not you are forced to allow someone to use your body against your will. And I would say that's probably the more important notion. I will say this. There was an interesting counter argument given. I don't know the source of this argument, but the argument essentially goes, say you're a person and you're standing on the balcony of a skyscraper, and you get a call from your boss to come meet him because he's thinking about giving you a promotion. And if you don't go at that point, then you won't get the promotion. So all of a sudden someone from the floor above you falls off of his balcony and he grabs onto your arm to save himself. And he's now using your arm to keep himself alive. Now, at that notion, would it be morally permissible of you to just go, get off me, and then just kind of sweep him off and let him fall and then go do your promotion thing? That's kind of an interesting question to me.
Question. Well, but the point is, I mean, first of all, holding onto your arm is not the same as getting off your biological processes, but at least that kind of debate, however you resolve it, can be solved by other than religion. You see, I don't have all the answers as what the law should be on every point. My only purpose is to argue that whatever the final legislative resolution that is binding a given society, religion should not be a component of it. So for our purposes, let's say that there is a legislative body made up completely of thoughtful atheists. They won't all agree on every single issue. Let's say that there is a thoroughly atheistic legislature in California and a thoroughly atheistic legislature in New York. Well, the laws may be different. For our purpose today on church-state separation, what we are trying to do is to say that whatever the ultimate result is of the law we all have to live under, even if that result is unpredictable, religion cannot be a component of it.
Completely agree with that notion. All right, so we're in our second hour right now. We've had a few questions from the panel, not the panel, but the audience, concerning your past debates with other people. The first question was concerning this, had to do with could you share your personal experiences with your debates, such as with Inwigan and Swinburne? Those debates were specified as to what exactly went into that? What's your personal take on what happened there?
Okay, let me focus in on Professor Swinburne of Oxford. Reputationally, he is perhaps the most respected Christian philosopher in the world. But what I found was the sessions that he made, thoroughly honest, gave me various openings. For instance, when he conceded that moral standards may exist independently of a God, that was an opening. His very honest admission of evolution, plus the fact that hell is not eternal. The one thing which surprised me is that in our debate, he did not defend his Bayesian theories on the probability of his supernatural claims. And I attacked him on it, but he wouldn't verbally defend those. And I think that what we have in Richard Swinburne is a non-fundamentalist who, based on his, what I think is incorrect, but sincere reading of the probabilities, has kind of a moderate Christian God existing. But he himself concedes too much, and you can use that to weaken the arguments. His admission of defects and flaws in the Bible, and see, one of the arguments I was able to make, it's interesting, one of my favorite philosophers teaches in Nova Scotia, J.L. Schellenberg, who wrote the book Divine Hiddenness and Human Reason. Professor Swinburne was his PhD advisor. And what Professor Swinburne doesn't realize is the implications of that. For instance, when he admits inaccuracies or defects in the Bible, well, we can say under divine hiddenness, if in fact there is an all-powerful God that wants us to know its will, it is unlikely that that God would give us a defective revelation which would make us doubt that being's omnipotence. And so a defective revelation from an all-powerful God that wants us to know his, her, its will is more likely if there is no God than if there is one. That's generally my take on the Swinburne debate.
And as far as Von Inwagen?
Who?
Von Inwagen?
Oh, as far as Peter Van Inwagen was concerned, he sort of just collapsed. He wouldn't do a full throttle defense of his position, and then he began to hedge on hell. Because you see, one of the things that I do, particularly if my opponent is defending Christian theism, is I immediately confront them with whether or not my mother, an Auschwitz survivor who remained by choice a Jew the rest of her life, is now in hell. If you accept fundamentalist Christianity, there's no doubt that she is. So that means that God put her through Auschwitz as a basically training camp for hell. And how do you, in terms of justice and fairness, justify that? So that is something also. Now, as far as, let's say, the big kahuna on the debate circuit, the one that everybody pays attention to, William Lane Craig, it's interesting because he will not debate me again after our 1999 debate, claiming that I don't have an academic PhD. Well, I mean, I sort of take that as a compliment, but he will not debate me again. And I think that's kind of interesting. But what I would say, in order to debate Bill Craig, you have to, of course, point counterpoint. You have to fire points out as rapidly as he does, but yet with his signature move, the glum cosmological argument on first cause, when he first disdains the notion that you can't have something from nothing, and yet God created something from nothing, it just takes it back a step. Also, if, as he claims, time and space came into being with the Big Bang, then how do you have cause and effect so you can even speak of a cause of the universe if there's no time and space for A to cause B? This is, again, ultimately a God of the Gaps argument. And the other thing that he does not explain, which I think is essential to a supernatural assertion of causation, is how an incorporeal being with no physical attributes can affect, let alone create, matter. Basically, how did God do it? What is the mechanism? How does a being... Yeah, so I'm saying these to me are major problems with the Kalam cosmological argument.
To note with that argument, like, I've asked, like, with Craig's premise, you know, the whole resurrection of Jesus. You're saying God resurrected Jesus. You're saying a verb. What mechanism did he use? Kind of the same thing like you just said, what the mechanism did God use to do the universe, right? Like, they say God can do things, yes, but they don't say how he does it. They
exactly.
Think that's not an answer, it's ignorance. Because you say, well, Zeus did rain. Okay, how did Zeus do rain? You know, like, it's not an explanation, it's just an assertion.
My whole thing now, sorry, go ahead.
Well, for instance, when Craig will say that the empty tomb is actually more explainable on a supernatural resurrection than on a natural cause, that's special pleading, because in no other case, in no other instance do we have that. If there is a noise in the attic and for 5 years we all go up and check and we can't find the physical cause of the noise, and yet it's there consistently 5 years, every day at 5 p.m., the same strange noise, we run up to the attic and can find nothing, no one would accept my argument that gremlins from the fifth dimension were the cause of that, because I would still demonstrate how a supernatural event could cause something. Well, obviously, a stolen body is much more within the realm of what happens in the physical universe than a supernatural resurrection.
You know,
so
you know what I remember? If I remember correctly.
He is, I mean, he basically, what?
I was going to bring up, like, I remember vaguely the Bible mentioned a scenario of Jesus getting his body taken by, I think, two grave robbers, I think it was, or something, and then buried in a ditch later. I think that was in the Bible. Can someone verify this?
Yes.
Well, whatever
Bible,
but maybe in some of the apocryphal literature, I don't know.
But I mean, I remember hearing that. So, like, isn't that a scenario that seems more plausible? Or the tomb was never actually never was actually used, or grave robbers took the body, or something like that?
Yeah, I've actually been having discussions with
excuse me.
Yeah, I've actually been having a discussion recently with this guy who's been trolling one of my videos. I'm gonna give him the benefit of mentioning his name, but he's on about this whole empty tomb thing and how all the naturalistic explanations can be discounted. And basically, my point of that is that so what? That leaves us with unknown naturalistic explanation as better than its magic anyway.
Could have been there was no body in the tomb to begin with. Could have been just a story.
Yeah, exactly. And it ultimately, it doesn't matter, because even if I can't explain it, it doesn't follow that there was a resurrection. I will accept that as a possibility when it is demonstrated that a human being can be dead for 3 days and come back to life. Until that's demonstrated, I don't care what they bring up.
There's a question from the chat room from Steve. And he wants to ask Edward if you could give anyone one tip or one trick on the skill of public speaking, debating, what would it be? Hello, Edward?
I'm having trouble hearing.
Oh, sorry.
The voices are breaking up. I'm not sure what's going on.
Okay. The question was if you could give people one tip on public speaking and debating, what would it be? Are you there, Edward? Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear, but the voices break up. So I'm, and again, being the tech dinosaur, I don't know how to handle that.
Right, Lundy.
When you're 62 years old, you didn't grow up with computers. So, some of the last few voices were just the commentary broke up.
Yeah. If you can hear me now, they're just asking what's the...
Yes, I can.
Yeah. What's the number one tip you can give to people for public speaking and debating? What's your number one piece of advice?
The number one what?
Your number one kind of tip or piece of advice you can give to anyone who wants to do...
Oh, the number one piece of advice for public speaking.
Yeah.
And that would... it depends on what the topic is. If it's a debate, you have to prepare as if you're preparing for a championship fight. You must study your opponent, prepare your arguments in advance, rehearse them, have them written out, be ready to respond to things you think your opponent might throw at you. Now, if it's a speech and you are presenting something that a general public audience is going to find to be offensive or upsetting, have your best arguments. For instance, later this month, I'm going to northern Minnesota, the Iron Range, and I'm going to be speaking to the general community in rural Minnesota about why God does not exist. My intent is to come on with very, very strong arguments, but to begin with the admonition that in no other area would someone accept supernatural claims. So I want the audience to ask themselves why religion should get a special pass, using my analogy of the gremlins in the attic. And then I'm going to ask the audience to give my arguments a fair hearing in light of the overwhelming evidence in our daily lives that the world is natural, not supernatural. And even if they disagree with me, ultimately, and still cling to supernatural theological beliefs, to make the effort to view what I'm saying as just an alternative to their views that they may want to argue against, but that does not deserve a blast of hostility, that basically see us as two scientists arguing about the best way to send a rocket to Mars, even though we're disagreeing. And that would take out some of the charge. Because you see, we atheists, particularly in America, have a two-pronged problem. We have to first present our arguments to the general public, but there's something else. Before we can do that, we have to persuade overwhelming masses of the American people that it's even socially appropriate for us to present those arguments. Many people are hostile that we atheists are even intellectually attacking religious beliefs, let alone giving our arguments a fair hearing. So we have a double hurdle.
Okay, Lundy, who's got the next question there?
For me, I just, Kalam in general, I know this is kind of going a little bit off topic here, but Kalam in general is something that I like to address. I have a huge issue with Kalam, and that's that whenever it's attacked, at least in a non-scholarly sort of setting like YouTube or any blog entries or anything like that, in general, I've witnessed Craig respond to people who are not, you know, his fellow scholars. And it's always very uncharitable. It's always very rude. It's always very, it's very, very bad. And there's a notion that there was an argument that was given, essentially, that all things that exist are made out of pre-existing material. There is no thing that is actually caused to exist in the same sense that the universe is caused to exist, because all things that are caused to exist these days, or at least as far as we've ever observed, and like ever, are from material, creatio ex materia. So the issue is that everything that begins to exist has a cause. Seems to rely on the ex materia causality. Meanwhile, we have the universe. There was no universe stuff to make a universe out of prior to the existence of the universe. So exactly how is this done? This is creatio ex nihilo, and that's a completely different creation than that's a completely different type of creation. It's a completely different type of causality than anything that we've ever witnessed in the first place. So it seems to me that a lot of people kind of miss the sort of, I would say it's, you could call it an equivocation fallacy, that Craig employs in his Kalam cosmological argument. But I just really want to mention this because this annoys me. Because he's addressed this critique in the past, but he hasn't actually addressed the critique. What he did was he said, there is this notion going around where a lot of people are saying that, nothing ever begins to exist because it's all made out of pre-existing material. And I think, what is wrong with these people? Have I never begun to exist? Was there not a moment in time in which my mother's egg and my father's sperm met and I was certainly created at some point? I believe that's exactly what happened. I agree they began to exist, so of course things begin to exist. He doesn't address the actual issue. He addresses this beat up straw man.
Straw man, yeah.
Actually trying to say.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the only thing that and when he does address this issue, because this has been brought up to him in scholarly works before too, he already admits that he doesn't have an answer for it. I think it was a debate he had in the 1990s. I can't remember who it was with, but they brought up this notion. They brought up the notion that, creatio ex nihilo doesn't have an actual causal chain. There's no philosophical definition or any other definition that is in any way coherent that can explain how something is created from nothing. And Craig's response to this was, well, that sucks for philosophy because that just seems intuitively true. So that's got to be true. I don't care that there isn't an actual coherent definition, but that's just what we're going to have to go with. Like, as soon as he actually addresses the actual argument, it seems so much weaker from his position. But he rarely does. And I think the reason, and this goes into a little bit of stuff that I can't possibly substantiate because I don't know Craig's mind, but I think the reason for this is because he understands as soon as he gives that concession, Kalam seems much, much weaker when you just say, well, you just got to have to rely on intuition. Yeah, none of it makes any sense through any sort of definitions that we use. But you just got to rely on your intuition. It just seems easier to picture that the universe was created in some way than that it wasn't. That's really what he relies on. And that is the most like convoluted bunch of rhetorical crap that I've ever seen. Like, our failures of intuition in order to grasp physics is just a phenomenal thing. It happens all the time. So to actually rely on that to justify a premise is, to me, mind blowing.
I mean,
well, I would say on. I mean, these are very, very profound points that you're making. I think that if we're looking for scholarly work by our people, as it were, trying to address that. Lawrence Krauss's book, Universe from Nothing, I believe is an effort to deal with this whole question of nothingness. Before I forget, because we were talking about government and religion, since I rarely have the opportunity to address a European audience, I would really like to urge all of you living in European nations, particularly the UK and the Netherlands, to begin to agitate and get together with other non-believers and begin to lobby for a repeal of all blasphemy laws from your nation. Because even though they have a benevolent intent, they're the worst kind of paternalistic types of laws, somehow believing that now particularly, and this is a flaw not of right-wingers, but of liberals who should know better, believing that Islam deserves some special insulation from criticism, and that rather than telling Muslims who move to your countries, you have to abide by our laws of free speech and the free marketplace of ideas, by saying, no, you and only you will get special insulation, or only religions will get special insulation from being offended. It is a legislative legal privileging of religion that has absolutely no justification. So I would urge those of you in European nations with a blasphemy law that protects one or more religions from being offended to work for the repeal of those laws, because that's not only a crucial element of church-state separation, it is an integral factor of preserving free speech.
Okay, there were some chat room questions, and I think Sir Strife wanted to fire them.
Yeah, one of the questions is, what statement you hear from theists, something what really boils your blood? What is the worst statement you hear?
Well, it's hard to pick out from among so many of them, but I think that one of the worst is, you can't prove God does not exist. Well, you see, the problem with that is the burden of proof is on the one that asserts the supernatural. And again, let's go back to my analogy of the gremlin in the attic. I can say, you can't prove that there's no gremlin from the fifth dimension in the attic, because every time we go up there, we've just heard a noise and no one can find the cause. So you must prove it's not the gremlin from the fifth dimension. And by the way, this gremlin from the fifth dimension that makes the noise in the attic wants us to burn a blue piece of paper in homage to it every day at 5 p.m. So no one would take that seriously. What that argument is, you can't prove there is no God, is saying that probabilities don't matter. Now, the one thing that I do with my opponents, except if they're presuppositionalists like my friend Doug Wilson, the pastor in Idaho, what I do is, all of them agree we are making probabilistic arguments. So if we're making probabilistic arguments, it's where does the weight of the evidence show? I believe that the weight of the evidence for the physical universe makes it far more likely than not that the inexplicable noise in the attic does not come from gremlins from the fifth dimension, and that the evidence for naturalism makes it equally more likely than not that God does not exist, with all the arguments we have, even though we're not going to do a 100% absolute proof. It's not necessary. We don't do 100 absolute proofs. So again, it is the theist trying to place God in a separate category of a more lenient proof requirement than any other paranormal claim. That, I think, is the most aggravating.
Also, I would say, to further expand on that point, what would you say is the most irritating argument you hear from a theistic position?
Well, that does the double
the most aggravated one, I guess.
That also would be it. You can't prove that there is no God. That would also be it. Another one is, how can you be good without God? The very notion that your moral values have to be tethered in a supernatural being in order to be reliable, I think that's a major one. Another aggravating one is the fine-tuning argument, where you're basically splitting atoms with your opponent. I think there are many answers
ironically,
to that.
I saw that with Slick. I mean, this was maybe before Strobel, but he was quoting what Strobel made a video of. Has anyone seen that video with the ruler where he says, you know, if you had a ruler...
Yeah, we've seen that.
Yeah, that's what he quoted exactly. Was that before this or after that?
I'm not sure. Our debate was in December of 2009. However, Victor Stenger has a book out called The Fallacy of Fine-Tuning that I'd recommend for everyone to read. Those would be it. Again, when you debate these people, if a Christian is going to want to engage you one-on-one online endlessly, it may not be worth it, because if after 50 rounds you're not willing to do any more, they declare victory. All debates, real debates, have a finite amount of time and rounds. And I think that you have a right to expect that, because otherwise you've got Christians with nothing better to do saying, well, after 100 rounds, he wouldn't do 101, I win. You have to watch out for that. Also, we atheists have just as much right as the theists to persuade people to our point of view. So in terms of the pragmatic characteristics of persuading people, I think it's good to confine your debates to audience view debates where you have a chance of reaching people, rather than endless emails with the Christian apologist who wants to doggedly wear you out.
Also, what do you think of the Gish Gallop?
The Gish Gallop, in case you're not exactly aware of what it was a technique that was popularized as far as rhetorical technique in debates by Dwayne Gish. Of creationist fame. Or rather infamy. It's the tactic of, you get up and your opening statement is making like a lot of points that are mostly wrong. And all of these points take a lot longer to debunk than they do to say. So inevitably, the next person is not going to be able to debunk all the points, either in their first one, either in their opening or in their rebuttal, which is the rebuttal is generally when they do that. And as a result, when they're not capable of debunking all of the points, the other debater who performed the Gish Gallop, so to speak, will get up and in their rebuttal say, you will notice that I gave several points on this, 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 and this that were not addressed. That were not addressed at all. They'll do that a lot.
And my opponent, the atheist, did not answer this, that, and this. Therefore, he's wrong.
Well, I have to talk to old Dwayne because he stole that from me. Because in my debate with Swinburne, after the opening statements, he said, well, you can't expect me to respond to the 101 points he just raised. So I have been criticized for that, too, though my arguments are 8 or 9, not the 100. But I don't know. Maybe Professor Swinburne did a Bayesian thing and came up with 100 out of 8. But anyway, what I would say is this. Obviously, even Bill Craig has 5 and sometimes 6. So what you can obviously do is you can tie many together. For instance, if absence of evidence of the supernatural, does double or triple duty say that? Or you can if they all have, let's say that there's, he hits you with 15 arguments, but in clusters of five, there are similar defects which are applicable to five of them. You can do it that way. Or you can just mention that it's impossible to refute all of them in depth, and that a debate cannot possibly be won just because the person in the opening statement is able to volley out more. You could point out that if you were debating Mr. Gish and you had the opening statement, you would have brought up 200 points, not the 100 he did, and he couldn't have responded either. You see, again, you can bring that down to common sense. It should be applicable across the board. So basically, you can argue that what Dwayne is saying is the debate is over the moment whoever gets the opening statement is able to volley a larger sheer number of arguments than can be responded to in rebuttal. And that can't be how a debate is won or lost.
I mean, like, isn't a debate supposed to be a format where the people present each side and the audience decides who wins, pretty much, right? That's how it's supposed to work, right?
Well, I wouldn't say the audience, because the audience may not be schooled. I mean, I would say, quite frankly, that a debate is won by whom technical philosophers would deem to have won the debate. For instance, if you're debating in front of a heavily Christian audience, they're going to deem the debater the winner. So as those of us.
Go ahead.
And so I think it's important to go for a technical win. I mean, certainly audiences don't determine debates. The technical points made. The number of punches you land versus your opponents, and the number of punches you block versus your opponents can also determine that. And an audience doesn't sit there with a punch meter to count.
No, but I was going to say, like, if one of them walks away with a different view, you convince them. Your argument was then you got them.
Oh, yes.
Like, that's what I would say. That's what I mean. Like, then the audience decides.
Oh, yeah, that part's true, yes. Yeah,
that's what I mean.
True. I mean, it frequently happens in my debates. The first time was at Queen's University in Kingston, Canada in 01, where I debated a man who was the head of their Campus Crusade for Christ, and 10 Christian Canadian students came up to me and said I didn't persuade them necessarily against God, but I did cast sheer doubt in their mind about whether or not it's fair for only those who believe in Jesus to be saved. And I said, well, that made the whole debate worthwhile, because that in itself was putting a sufficient dent in the theological construct that I'm seeking to undo. So, yes, absolutely.
Lundy.
There was a couple points that I wanted to bring up. The first, just going into the whole debate thing in the first place. I love reading old debates, like a long time ago. Even now, debates majoritively aren't actually done in sort of a live audience kind of way. They tend to be done through like a series of articles written in conjunction by the two debaters. One would send their article to the other. He would write his rebuttal and all that kind of stuff. And that would just be made into one nice little book for people to read. In the older debates, you can kind of notice that there's a huge shift in the attitude of the debaters, as compared to today. Today, it's a lot more venomous between people who participate in the debates. It's a lot more attacking. It's a lot more. It's less helping each other trying to come to a conclusion. More, this person's wrong, butting heads kind of thing. It's sort of like two goats just crashing against each other all the time. And when you go back to, say, Bertrand Russell's time, and you look at the debates at that time, it was to me, I wouldn't say it's like better. From an entertainment standpoint, it's definitely a lot more boring. because they're not attacking each other as much. It's a lot more, okay, would you agree with this premise? Would you agree with that premise?
I think that in terms of it being more headbutting and more competitive as far as being more collegial, is in the United States, as time goes on, the rift between the religious and non-religious is growing. And I think that the stakes are higher than ever before. And also, in any kind of social, philosophical, or political dispute, you can see more intensity and you can see more hostility. I mean, look at the election cycle in the just concluded presidential campaign last year, and look at the amount of acrimony that characterized the debates and the campaigns. Certainly, when as this continues without abatement, it becomes more likely that both debaters, particularly if you're debating, does God exist, both of us will see the opponent as someone who must be overcome, particularly when there are the minds of college students at stake. It is so important for my Christian opponent to win them for Christ. It's so important for me to win them for naturalism. The level of intensity is simply going to escalate. And we just have to live with that. And the thing we can do is our side just keep refining our arguments. I mean, I've always said the only example of infinity I've seen is the amount of patience one has to have to continue to prepare for debates.
The only other point that I wanted to bring up, and this goes back a good while in the discussion, was when a theist brings up you can't disprove God, those theists, I don't think they pay attention a whole lot to Billy Craig as much as they think they probably do, because I've seen interviews with Craig being told, hey,
it's kind of hard to hear you. You're breaking up. Yeah.
Terribly sorry. Might have something to do with my connection here. I'll just close a couple things. Is that any better?
Hello, Edward?
Can you hear me any better now?
I hear him.
Yeah, I can hear now.
Okay.
Evidently, the people who say that you can't disprove God are not big fans of Billy Craig. Because when you watch interviews with Craig, and he's asked the question, like, what do you say to people who say that you can't disprove God? You can't prove a negative, so to speak. He'll say, well, that's obviously absurd. You can always prove a negative. I can prove there isn't an apple in my hand right now. I can prove that there isn't a gremlin in my pocket right now. Most philosophers would agree that you can, in fact, prove a negative, depending on what the negative is, depending on the concepts of the negative, all these kinds of things. And as a result, like, that can be debated as to whether or not it's an actual possibility, but it seems to me that if the person that a lot of the sort of modern day theists who are getting into the debate scene get their arguments from, generally William Lane Craig, Alvin Plantinga, Richard Swinburne, those tend to be the top three. If one of those guys says, "Hey, you can't prove you can in fact prove negative," and they're saying that you can't, then it seems to me that these Christians who like to say, well, atheists don't know anything about philosophy. You're all these materialist, empiricist, scientism type people, and you don't actually understand the finer points of nuanced philosophy. They haven't really read a whole lot either. They haven't been paying a lot of attention, because clearly there's a lot of people who, in the scholarly world, disagree with this statement.
Well,
that you cannot...
well, like Craig, right? Craig thinks relativity something weird with. I mean, Marty knows a lot about this. The whole special relativity, I think it is.
Yeah, he completely butchers it.
Craig tries to go into the realm of empiricism and science, even though, it doesn't work. It doesn't work.
Yeah, he he thinks he can use philosophy to disprove something that has been confirmed scientifically, and it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, it really doesn't.
I was in the interview with Craig when he was asked what would shake his faith, but he'd say Jesus, the Holy Spirit, told him that it's right. You know, his faith was right. I think it was. You seen that video?
If you ask
that question, you cannot disprove God. When you say that, it sounds like in your tone you're saying, "Well, I'm going to believe it, even if you bring me evidence that there's no reason to believe it." Seems to me, that's
see,
the
now,
only reason.
Now, I think we have a right. We have a right then to say that this is not the substance of debate, and that this is not an empirically verifiable component, and thus can be discarded. The Holy Spirit told me. Now, let's take Calvinist presuppositionalists, of which I count Alvin Plantinga one, saying God is properly basic. Well, God is properly basic. How come he's not basic to me? Ah, well, you see, I'm lacking the sensus divinitatis. I don't have the built-in TV, television antenna to notice God. Well, that's the same as a three-year-old child saying, meet my invisible friend Ralph. But we'll say, but we don't see Ralph. Well, because you don't have the right goggles on to see the invisible Ralph. That's no different. So to claim that in a world where the overwhelming evidence is of naturalism, you need special goggles to see the supernatural is an incredibly childish argument. It could apply to anything. I mean, I would tell Plantinga that the reason he's a Calvinist and not a Buddhist meditator is his mechanism to see that the highest levels of consciousness can be reached by going into stillness and Buddhist meditation is dysfunctional, and that he has a defect that makes him believe in an external punishing God rather than a cosmic mush that you can blend with and find bliss. And that his sensus buddhitatis is not working. So yeah. These, to me, are not arguments, and I think they can be shot down. Basically, what it is whether it's Craig's communicating with the Holy Spirit, God telling Bush to run for president, Plantinga's sensus divinitatis, they all come down to this, which is I have a direct communication with the divine, which even though I can't prove is real and is binding on you. In no other context would we say that. If I walked into one of Craig's Christian seminars and said, Bill, I just got a communication from the alien forces that govern this earth, and I am now emperor of the United States, and you guys have to stop this faulty worship and build me my castle now because I got a direct communication, they wouldn't believe me. So why should their claim of direct communication with the Holy Spirit be more credible than my claim of being the chosen one of the alien forces that govern this planet? There are no standards. There's no falsifiability.
Okay, guys. We have 10 minutes left, so final questions from the panel for Edward.
What do you think of the modal ontological argument?
Excuse me?
Lundy got it. What do you think of Plantinga's modal ontological argument?
I can't hear you. The Plantinga will what?
Plantinga's modal ontological argument.
What I think about Plantinga is the professional philosophical community has given him an unjustified pass. I think for him, playing proper basicality, to claim that there is a mechanism of direct knowing all without proof is, in terms of analytic philosophy or any intellectual rigor, it's great. And it's basically saying that what he believes is so basic, it doesn't require any proof, even though it's an assertion about a supernatural being and the will of that being. Well, that can apply to any paranormal being. It can apply to space.
I'm speaking of his ontological argument, his modal one, the one that pretty much Craig uses. I mean, everybody uses it pretty much, I think it is.
You're talking about the ontological argument?
The modal.
Yeah. The modal.
The what?
What?
The modal ontological argument by Alvin Plantinga.
Meaning, are you talking about the Anselmian ontological argument, that the very fact that our minds can conceive of a great being of which no greater can be must mean he exists?
It's like this being, if he exists in a conceptual world, he exists necessarily possible in all possible worlds, therefore he exists in the real world, therefore God exists. I think that's the one, right?
Well, first of all, how do we know that he can exist in all possible worlds? Just because...
Because he's necessarily possible.
Doesn't make reality.
No, but he's necessarily... God is defined as necessarily. That's the thing he does.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Well,
he defines God as existing.
But you see, what justifies epistemically saying he's necessarily possible? He may be possible.
I guess when he says it's basic, okay, that's what he...
goes back to our basic analogy. You see, then I'll say to Plantinga, okay, Alvin, prove he's properly basic, and he says, I can't because you don't have the right mechanism. Once again, it comes down to the subjective claim, as I have the inside line to the divine and you don't, unless you have the same antenna that I do, you can't receive this information. Well, I could say the same thing about my space aliens. Basically, he is making an unempirical claim. He is saying that he has a subjective line. I mean, it's no different than some hippie coming down out of the Hollywood Hills, marching across the Sunset Boulevard, claiming that Jesus just told him to start a new cosmic religion and that all the beautiful young women have to follow him to the beach. There's no more proof of that than there is of proper basicality.
I join that in a heartbeat.
If I was a lesser ethical person, I might actually do that.
maybe it's because I'm a godless atheist. Maybe that's it.
I just have one more question before we start closing up here. Matt Slick, you've debated Matt Slick in the tag argument.
I'm having trouble hearing you again.
Terrible. Sorry.
Matt Slick in the tag argument.
Yep. Lundy, I think we're getting feedback from you.
Right now?
No, not now, so try asking the question again.
Okay, you debated Matt Slick in the tag argument. You debated other presuppositionalists in the past. Just what is your advice as far as approaching these kinds of arguments, the presuppositionalist arguments, the tag argument, all these different variations?
What you do with the presuppositionalist is you don't concede it. You don't debate them on their turf. You say they have no epistemological right to dodge evidentiary arguments. And you launch into your evidentiary arguments the same as you do with proper basicality. If you can't in any way prove that you have this insight, if you can't prove that you have this divine connection that gives you infallible truth. I mean, basically, the Pope is saying, when I speak ex cathedra, I'm infallible. We say, prove it. Prove that because you were chosen by your fellow cardinals, that the ultimate force in the universe infuses you with interpreting its will without mistake. You prove it. We don't have to accept that. Give us evidence. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. It's also a form of argument without evidence. So the Vatican is saying,
when a group of our cardinals choose one of their own, the ultimate force in the universe infuses that chosen one with an unmistakable ability to convey the will of God. Well, prove it. The burden of proof is on you. And if so, someone says, the fact that we can merely think and reason means the Trinitarian God exists, will prove it. What are the connections? It's a bald assertion. I can say the very fact that we can reason and think means that cortical neurons and synapses are functional in the human brain, which is indicative of the fact that consciousness will cease when the brain dies and there's no soul and there's no life after death to go to heaven and hell in the first place. Refute that. You know, again, so you don't allow them to take evidentialism out of play. You use evidentialism to knock down their claim of not having to go through proofs. You know, once again, there are gurus throughout history that have done very well by claiming a special channel to truth that their disciples will benefit more for than anything else on the planet if they follow that, because this person is the most divine. This person is the most realized. This person has the best inside track to the will of the divine. And you put them to an evidentiary proof.
Okay. I think we can start to wrap things up here. So very quickly, Eddie, to close out, if there's anything you want to promote or any advice you want to give to
us. Yes.
Here's your soapbox.
There is one, again, I want to emphasize, because it's very rare that I am privileged to address a somewhat European audience, and that is work in concert with each other to repeal your nation's blasphemy laws if they have them. Do not allow your governments to believe that any religion has special rights to silence its critics. If Muslims come to our countries, they must fit into our system of free expression and separation of government and religion. We don't have to modify for them or for anybody else. And if you're in Holland, work to repeal the blasphemy laws that still exist. If you're in England, do the same. If you're in any other country, work to repeal all laws that criminalize giving offense to religion. The marketplace of ideas is where all disputes must be hashed out. And no religion, no theological belief system has any special right to use the police power of the state to dodge criticism, ridicule, and doubt.
Okay, everyone. Thank you very, very much to Edward for taking the time out and coming on to the show. It's been fascinating. It's been fantastic. Thank you to my co-host. Thank you to Sir Strife for coming in at the last minute to co-host with me.
Wait, can I just note the show?
Yeah, you can shout out your own show, of course.
The show is going to be on 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard. So if you're in Britain, it'll be midnight. next Saturday, we'll start doing a British time show,
a British,
I guess,
friendly.
Because there's an open slot. What?
A British-friendly show.
Well, yeah, I guess. I mean, except I don't know what the British word for ghost would be, so I guess we should call it the Goost. The Lying Goose show for the British.
Okay, and as always, thank you, Lundy.
Pleasure being here, as always.
And Mortimer, thank you for coming along.
Thanks.
And we are back same time next week. We are back with our famous live pwnage. We're looking at a question of origins. And then a week after that is our next guest, which is Dr. Stephen Law, who is the editor of the Royal Journal of Philosophy. Which you can see Lundy's face there straight away. So thank you very much, everyone. Good night, and we'll see you all next week. Thank you very much.
Later, bye. Bye.